So I'm Mike Huberman, interviewing Tyler Willis.
And I'm Sean Robb, interviewing Tyler Willis as well.
I'm Tyler Willis, business finance major at the University of Montana. It is November 12th, 2014, TYLORWILLIS, middle name Smith, SMITH.
Can you identify, what your company was?
Oh, right on. Okay, my unit, 3rd Battalion, 5th Marines, 1st Marine Division, India Company, 1st Platoon. I was joined the Marines August 27th, 2007, and EAS August 26th, 2011.
And just mention where we are now.
We are in the Don Anderson Journalism Building on the first floor of the Journalism Building of the University of Montana.
Okay, sweet.
What made you decide to join the military at first?
I joined the military. I joined specifically the Marines because I felt like the reputation that they had in my mind was the one that I could most align with. But I joined the military in general because when I was 19, which is when I joined, I wanted to do something bigger and better. I wasn't happy with just going to college. I did my first year of college straight out of high school, and it just felt like an extension of high school. So I knew I wanted to do something bigger. I felt like it was a good way to do something that wasn't really for myself, because I knew that if I went, that meant that somebody else who didn't want to go wouldn't have to in the long run, in the grand scheme of things. So that's why I joined the military and then the Marines, just because I wanted to be on the ground, kicking down doors and pulling triggers.
Where were you born?
Kalispell, Montana, January 6, 1988.
And who are your parents?
My mom is Terry Rainwater, and my dad is Paul Willis.
And do you have brothers and sisters?
I have a younger brother, Chase Willis, who was born March 1st of 1990, and he's in the Army right now.
What did your family think about you joining the military?
My dad was in the Air Force for a long time. I want to say he was active duty for 6 years or something like that, and then he was in the Montana Air National Guard for over 20 years, and a good chunk of that he was at Malmstrom Air Force Base in Great Falls. So I had always known that he was in the Air Force growing up. And when I started talking about joining the military in general and throughout high school, he kind of probably didn't take it as seriously, but he would always, he wanted me to join the Air Force, I think, a little bit more. And the day that I told him I finally enlisted, he wasn't very happy about it, but he got over it pretty quickly. And probably just a little bit of shock because I didn't keep him up to date with the intensity of my seriousness, if that makes sense. My mom, I was living with her when I signed the paperwork, and she wasn't very happy about it. But when I convinced her, or not convinced her, I didn't need to be convinced or anything, but eventually she understood kind of where I was coming from. She understood my motivation, and she supported me eventually.
When were you drafted, or what happened when you were drafted?
I enlisted voluntarily, so the process that you go through when you decide you want to join, I was speaking with a recruiter, and I had been for probably just shy of a month before I actually went to boot camp, just going through the process of trying to figure out what I wanted to do, what the whole process was like, familiarize myself with what, the commitment would be like. So when I started speaking with a Marine recruiter, narrowed down my job, which ended up being an 0311 infantry rifleman. The way that it works is after I tell him, yes, this is what I want to do, and he confirms that he can do that for me, that, yeah, there's a spot, you can fill that spot and we'll reserve it for you, because different recruiters have different allotments that they can fill. After he confirmed it, I had to go down to, this was in Wisconsin, by the way, I had to go down to Milwaukee, which is the Military Enlistment Processing Center. They call it MEPS. You have to go down there and meet physical requirements. It's a whole day thing to make sure you're physically fit, mentally fit. They want to be able to screen you and know exactly what they're getting out of you, so there are no surprises when you're actually in. So did that MEPS day, They put me in the delayed entry program, and I was a poolie. You have to attend recruiters, like PT sessions, you know, physical training and that kind of thing, until finally my day came where I had to go down to Milwaukee, and they flew me to MCRD, which is the Marine Corps Recruit Depot, San Diego. And I did that August 27th of 2007, and that was pretty much the process that you have to go through.
So when you were going through that process, and you had an expectation of what it was going to be like, you know, you've been being prepared, and you'd been whatever you found out about it, you know, through your training and through what people had been telling you. Tell me a little bit about what it was like. Did it match your expectations once you actually began your job and doing the work that the guys had to start doing? Was it the same thing that you thought it was going to be, or what was the difference there if there wasn't?
Are you talking about like the difference between boot camp and like the actual Fleet Marine Corps, or are you talking about before boot camp compared to boot camp? Or
I'm saying after you went through boot camp and you're like, okay, we're ready to deploy, we don't know where.
Okay,
but
right.
Then you did. What was it like? Was it
completely different? There's no preparing for it. You learn, you know, and one of the common things that they'll say, you know, is when we would go from graduate from either boot camp and go to the School of Infantry, or from the School of Infantry to the Fleet Marine Corps, which are deploying Victor units, you know, one of the things that you'd always constantly hear is forget everything you know, we do it differently here. So it's kind of the whole idea is that when you go to boot camp, they're turning you from a civilian into just basically reformatting your hard drive, I guess is the best analogy that I can think of. You know, we want a blank slate to know exactly what we're dealing with, remove any kind of attitude to just so you understand exactly, to do exactly as you're told. And then when you go from boot camp to the School of Infantry, you start actually learning skills, how to work different weapon systems, how to, you know, kind of learn some of the nuances of command structure, that kind of thing. You know, you learn a little bit more, you start getting a few more abilities. And then finally, when you get to the fleet, you think you know how to do everything textbook by the textbook, which is what they teach at the schoolhouse. And then the fleet does things completely differently. They do things based on what works. You know, it's all experience that's passed down generation to generation. So it's completely different. And I think you'd have a hard time finding somebody who said that SOI, School of Infantry, prepared them for the fleet. And then even another step forward is that once you do a workup in the fleet, which is with your deploying unit, you'll do training packages and do different training events and that kind of thing. And then once you actually go to country, it's completely different there because every deployment is unique. And so where you may have been preparing for one situation one way in the fleet, once you're actually in Afghanistan, we found that, oh, well, that doesn't work for this reason, so we're going to do it differently. So it's constantly learning, but there are certainly principles that you learn in boot camp that definitely carry over no matter what the situation is. So when they, you know, attention to detail, being disciplined, those kinds of things that they teach you are constant, that never change. So you never say, oh, well, now that we're in this situation, you don't need to be disciplined anymore. That would never happen. So some things are universal truths. Some things are more dynamic and change.
So after, you know, SOI and boot camp and all that, you and the fifth, you guys went to the Western Pacific. You know, can you kind of describe to me that that kind of year? You were there for a year. Can you kind of describe that?
Right.
What that was like?
Right, yeah. They call it the 31st MEU, and MEU stands for Marine Expeditionary Unit. And basically, the 31st was unique from other MEUs in that we were kind of, to my understanding anyways, in my experience, we were kind of a training MEU. So we went, first of all, we went from California to Okinawa, Japan, and we were at Camp Hansen, Japan, which is where Okinawa's 1 infantry battalion stationed, and from there we became part of that MEU, and we were the battalion landing team of that MEU. So we went and did some training with Japanese military forces there. We did some training actually in World War II Japanese trenches and did some of that kind of training just by ourselves. But then also we would embark on Navy ships and go to, first we went to Thailand and trained for what they called Cobra Gold, which is a military exercise that's between Thai Marines and U.S. Marines. And then we would go back to Okinawa, do some more training there. And so it was kind of like every month and a half or 6 or 8 weeks or something like that, we'd go to a different country and train. And so the second one we went to was the Philippines. And then the third one we went to was Australia. And we had one company in our battalion that went to South Korea to train with ROK Marines, which is Republic of Korea Marines. But so each country that we went to, we would just do a training package that was kind of designed to simulate, you know, a possible war scenario, combat scenario kind of thing. And we would try to cross-train each other. So, for example, U.S. Marines taught Filipino Marines how to, you know, do pre-combat checks, pre-combat inspections, kinds of our forte, you know, the urban combat kinds of things, how to check, you know, have accountability so that there's, you know what you're getting in a Marine. You know that he's going to know how to handle a weapon. You know he's going to know how to follow orders, you know, that kind of thing. But there, it was kind of, there was a large variation, I feel like, in the quality. You know, you'd have some guys who hadn't been there very long, who maybe hadn't done a lot of training, and some guys were really awesome and had been in for 20 years, and you just never knew what you were going to get. So, and they would then teach us their kind of skills, like how to set a bird trap or how to, you know, set up a little shelter in the woods when it's raining, you know, an inch a night or something like that, and how that their kind of specialty that we weren't very good at. And that's the kind of training that we did on that deployment.
How did you feel about that tour? Did you feel like that was what, you know, you wanted to do? Or
it was kind of exciting. It was my first deployment, and it was kind of exciting for everybody. Even the senior Marines who were in my unit were kind of intrigued by it because they had all been to Fallujah, Iraq, on their deployments, because our unit had gone to Fallujah, I think, 6 or 7 times in a row. And so there were not very many people in our unit who had ever done a MEW. There were a couple, but not very many. So it was just kind of a novel thing, like, oh, we're going to go see these new countries and see some new territory, that kind of thing. It was interesting, but definitely there was kind of a feeling that this isn't what we signed up for. This isn't what we trained to do. It's just is to be peacetime dog and pony shows. It was kind of frustrating in that, you know, here we did all this training, went through all these miserable training packages, trained for war, and then we got more training. So we're trained to train, which is extremely frustrating when you put in the perspective of all the sweat and blood and tears and how hard we worked to prepare for war, and then to just, oh, well, you don't get to go to war. You're going to go do some more training, which is kind of frustrating, which is kind of counterintuitive because I know a lot of people would say, well, why would you want to go do that, you know? But when you're training for something, you want to test your mettle. So it was definitely difficult, and there was a little bit of resentment to the deployment for sure.
What was the craziest thing you saw when you were doing that tour? Like, was there, what was the coolest part or the most interesting country or, like?
There were really amazing parts. We got to, in Thailand, we could look from the island we were on. I mean, in the Philippines is where we were. When we were in the Philippines, we could look out, kind of look across one of the bays that we were staying at. We could see Corregidor, which is really cool, a really famous island from World War II. And we could just see, like, Japanese beach defense guns that were old and rusty. And so I've got pictures on one of my cameras of a bunch of us who went out to go PT and ran out and found this old Japanese beach gun that was mounted there, and it was powered by pedals to adjust the elevation and windage. And we parked on there and just kind of pedaled it around. It still worked and everything. Obviously, there was no ammunition. It was all rusted. But we just got to sit on it and kind of aim around, and you could see how they could kind of envision how the Japanese manned it during the war. We got to see in Australia, got to see some beautiful country, cover a lot of territory in Australia. In Japan, again, we got to see on Okinawa World War II Japanese fighting trenches, which is really amazing, and to crawl through the same trenches that they were. So there were definitely ups and downs, just like anything. Still to this day, even after having been blown up and been in firefights, Australia, the training event we were on in Australia was one of the most miserable times of my life, even including getting shot at. And it's hard to describe if you weren't there. But very miserable. But then again, when we had free time off, and we did get liberty, which is time off when you can go spend money, essentially, is why the locals liked it. I had some great times, and it was just a different experience, but definitely one that I'll remember forever, and it was a great one. I think overall, now that I can look back at it and don't have to, you know, kind of like a crazy ex-girlfriend, you remember the good times, but you don't remember the bad times.
Could you describe some of the things you went through in Australia?
Right. Okay, so we did this mission, and I wanted to say, I think it was called Talisman Saber or something like that, or that may be wrong. That may have been one of the other ones, but it was a mission where we were supposed to work with the Australian Defense Forces and basically, I'm trying to think of the best way to the word, basically make a long movement. So we were, my company and our battalion landing team, 3-5, we were divided into three companies. One company was a helicopter company, another one was a tracked vehicle company, and we were the boat company. So we were Zodiac boat raiders on those little rubber combat boats that you see sometimes. And so they dropped us off in the middle of the ocean, and we took those little rubber boats 7 hours up this river, and it was freezing cold. You wouldn't think so, that Australia would be freezing cold, but there were icicles hanging off people's earlobes. Just miserable. Already I knew that this was going to be, I mean, it was like a week-long mission. We didn't have enough gear. We didn't bring the gear that we thought, we didn't bring the gear that we should have, because here we thought, oh, it's July in Australia, it'll be fine. And it was freezing, miserable cold. We weren't dressed, sopping wet. We had too much gear. And then because we got lost, luckily, we didn't have to land on this beach made of basically peanut butter mud in the dark, luckily. So because we got lost and we're there for on this river for 8 hours instead of seven, we landed just at dawn and had to get off the boats in this really deep peanut butter, sticky mud on the side of this beach, and immediately all of our gear was sopping wet. Batteries that were in our packs had exploded and battery acid all over our gear. Everything was dirty and wet and cold and miserable, and then we started hiking with heavy waterlogged packs, and we're wet, every cold all the time, moving through the jungle a lot of distance with a lot of heavy gear. Miserable, miserable, miserable.
And that was just to train.
That was a training event, yeah.
So, was that, Australia was the last part of that kind of southern, that tour of the islands?
Right, it was, yeah. That was the last leg that my company did. I think, I can't remember if the Lima company was in South Korea at some point. I don't remember if they, when they were there, but the battalion as a whole, I'm pretty sure Australia was the last leg that we did, and we were there, I think, all told with Liberty and the training event, maybe 3 weeks? I feel like 3 weeks sounds about right, but I can't remember the exact figure that we were there. And then we went back to Okinawa, and then the end of the deployment was when we left Okinawa back for the States.
And then after you went back to the States, you went to Afghanistan.
Right, sure did. Yeah, we did another workup. So after we got back, I want to say we got back from the MU, it would have been maybe August of 2009. We did another workup, which is another training event that you get new Marines, you know, because you're constantly cycling in new Marines because older Marines are getting out. And so we got our new batch, did a whole workup with them. And then actually we were originally scheduled to not do Afghanistan. We were scheduled to do, I think, another MU. And at some point during the workup, they decided to send us to Afghanistan. And everybody was thrilled about it. It was when our lieutenant came and told us we were doing a training event actually outside practicing patrolling, and when he came and called our whole platoon in, it was like you would have thought he just said, congratulations guys, you have a month off, paid vacation, and we're all going to go to Hawaii. Because everybody, it was the same kind of response. Everybody was happy, high-fiving. Everybody was ecstatic because that's exactly what we wanted. And for my generation, because that was my second deployment, it was my last chance to go on a combat deployment, and sometimes you get what you wish for. And yeah, but people were definitely happy to get that experience. So we did our workup, and then we finally deployed September 2010 and came back.
So how many months was that?
7 months, I think. Yeah, about 7 months. And we came back April 2011. Mm-hmm. So I think that's about 7 months.
And you were deployed to Sangin, am I pronouncing that?
Yep. Hold on 1 second, I want to rewind. So wait, did you know Mandy? When did she get into the, like...
I was dating Mandy before I joined the Marines.
Okay.
Yeah, I've been dating her 7.5 years now. So I knew her, actually started dating her right before I went to boot camp.
So what did she think when you decided to agree? Like, did she already know you were going to go back for a second tour? Or like, how did that work?
Yeah, she, so I told her that because I went into that delayed entry program that I talked about earlier. I did that actually on her birthday, February 15th of 2007, which was her birthday, but I didn't know her then. And that basically said that, yes, I'm committing to join the Marine Corps and made a commitment. And then shortly thereafter, actually, I met her and we started dating then months after. And I told her that I was joining the Marines. And so we just kind of kept dating and we both wanted to stay together. So we did. And it worked out.
Nice. So you went to Sangin and that wasn't, you know, the British left there a little before you guys, but it was kind of, you know, some people said it was one of the messier parts of the Afghanistan war. Can you kind of talk about the initial reaction of getting there?
Right. And we kind of knew some of those things. We kind of knew that Sangin was kind of a hot spot. The Taliban had been pretty active there. And so when we first got there, I think before our company, because the way the battalion goes on a deployment like that, they kind of go in waves. So it wasn't just all at once everybody was there. It was kind of, there were like advance parties who would get there, and then main bodies would start coming, like companies at a time on planes and that kind of thing. Before my company even got there, I think we already had a casualty. There was an IED that blew up one of the vehicles, and one of our motor T sergeants, I think, had already been injured before the whole battalion even got there. So we immediately knew, okay, well, they're serious about it. It's not going to be a standing post deployment, and it wasn't. It was pretty rough when we first got there. Started taking casualties immediately. One of the first KIAs that we had was John Sparks from my company. He's one of the machine gunners, and he died on one of the first missions we did outside the wire, where we actually did a little clearing operation of this kind of dry riverbed area. And he was there, and he was shot and killed the first day we actually, our very first mission. And immediately after that, other companies started taking casualties. We were finding multiple IEDs a day, getting in firefights guaranteed. It was like clockwork. Every day we went outside the wire, they would wait until you were in kind of a compromising situation, forced by the terrain or just anything. And then they would start engaging you, and then you'd fight back and then come back to the patrol base. And it was kind of like clockwork. You knew every day pretty much that when you're going out, you're going to take contact and get in a firefight. So it stayed like that for a while, but the Taliban kind of operates seasonally. So when we first got there, they were still fighting, and then it kind of tapered off and it started becoming more of an IED battle, where we were getting in fewer and fewer firefights, but encountering more and more IEDs, which is their tactic during the cold months before they get more reinforcements. So that kind of started right around maybe December or something like that. Right around December, I think, is when they kind of, we had fewer firefights, and they more just sort of resorting to pop shots, you know, to try to just get lucky, maybe get a lucky shot off, that kind of thing, but they wouldn't stand toe-to-toe anymore. And then we would just find a lot of IEDs.
You know, is there, you know, that you were only there for 7 months, but is there any day that stands out to you that you, you know, you'll never forget?
There are a lot of days like that. The day that I got blown up is the first day that comes to mind. My squad, second squad, we were doing an Overwatch mission, and we had been, we left our patrol base, and we were kind of watching over tanks as they were firing these Miklik rockets down roads, which are basically, they're huge rockets that are laden with C4, kind of, so when they fire off and they land, and behind them there's a whole string of C4 and packages designed to blow up the whole road and clear any mines, that kind of thing, just so you know where you're walking, because there was such a threat of IEDs. And we were supposed to watch over the tanks and make sure that nothing was going wrong so that they had security. And once they were done, just the kind of short and dirty of it is we were leaving this building, and one of my squad mates stepped on an IED that blew up our squad. He lost a leg, and the other one was severely damaged. Our squad leader had pretty significant injuries. One of our interpreters had significant injuries to his face and eyes as well. I was pretty superficially injured. My ear was split open, and I took some shrapnel and kind of had a concussion. But I walked away from it and was happy for it, considering how much worse it could have been. So they evacuated all the casualties, including myself, and that was definitely a day that I'll never forget as one of them.
How did you go on after that, you know, knowing that you kind of, that happened, how did you, how was your mindset towards the rest of the tour?
It's strange because now I look back on it and my mind has definitely changed, but at the time I remember thinking, you know, kind of feeling like we were a little bit defeated because they had such a, you know, that was kind of like a jackpot for the Taliban to injure so many Marines at one time, but it was just kind of the situation that we were in. It was just, it was like one in a million kind of thing that we'd be so close together for one IED to hurt so many guys. It was difficult for sure to push on, but, you know, everybody kind of had the attitude of we're going to keep pushing on and we're still going to get the job done and mission accomplished. And in fact, the rest of the squad still went on and continued the mission. So even after they did our CASAVAC, there was no canceling the mission. They finished and the rest of the squad went and completed their mission. And 7 days later, once they cleared me medically, I was back with my platoon again.
And any other instances like that where you got injured?
Me specifically, I was just the one time. But there were other times where we were in firefights where you could see tracers whizzing between you and the Marine next to you kind of thing. Sustained firefights for a long time where we started running out of ammunition and we were waiting for backup, or QRF, they call it, quick reaction force, which is like reinforcements kind of thing. You can think of it that way. Days where, you know, pretty terrified, but at the same time kind of like still functioning. So by terrified, you know, you realize the gravity of the situation, but still have the mindset of, well, I'm still going to do my job, and you're still reacting appropriately. And I'm proud to say that, you know, we didn't have any guys who didn't do exactly what their job was. So I feel like, you know, my reaction was pretty typical of everybody, that this is our job. This is what we signed up for to do. We knew that this was an option. This is what we wanted. This is what we're getting. We're going to deal with it and not complain. That's how we did it. Another time, for example, our PB, which was pretty small, we called it PB Sparks, but they call it Barry Oli, which is something in Pashtun, which I don't have any idea what it means. But we were in our little squad bays, and it was kind of nighttime. I don't remember what time it was, but I started hearing one of the posts shooting machine guns, shooting at somebody who's doing something that they shouldn't be, that's kind of threatening. So it's not very unusual to hear machine gun bursts throughout the night or just randomly. Nobody, it's not even a big deal. But this night we started hearing machine guns firing, kind of sustained, kind of lasted for a while, and then other posts started shooting. And then I could hear commotion going on outside of our squad base. Immediately, as soon as we heard that, everybody started throwing on gear, running up to posts, and we realized we were under attack. We had later found out there, I guess there were like 50 to 100 Taliban trying to sneak up on the posts to overrun our base, because I think we only had maybe 15 guys or something like that on this whole base, including the guys who were on posts. So we were definitely outnumbered, and they knew it, because they... my guess is that they could recognize the guys on post when they'd be watching us on post. They recognize these guys are on post a lot. There must not be a lot of them. And we were still sending out patrols. So they knew they kind of had us, you know, at a weak spot being so undermanned. But luckily the posts were proactive, caught the Taliban trying to sneak up on us from little dead spots that you couldn't see behind. And they were kind of doing it, you know, just at dusk, starting to sneak up like that. and they wanted to get the jump on us, but luckily we caught them and repelled them. We had helicopters and mortars helping us out and supporting us. So eventually we had Mark 19s and 50 cal machine gun vehicles pulling up to our walls and supporting us, and we repelled the attack. And this is what I heard. I don't know how much truth there was, but they found a lot of bodies outside. So we it was a pretty decisive win for us, and that kind of reinvigorated everybody's, you know, spirit and morale. It was a pretty big win for us that way.
So were you anywhere else besides Afghanistan? Then what was that? What was the next part of the timeline?
After Afghanistan, yeah. After I got back from Afghanistan, that was April 2011. That was my last deployment. So I did two deployments, and after that, the separation period was kind of you've got to do medical, and because I had gotten that concussion and been hurt a little bit, started going to medical for you know, headaches and sleep disorder and that kind of thing. But pretty much you begin the process. It's a long, complicated process of exiting the military. You have to be medically cleared. You have to be, you know, turn in all the gear, get the signatures. It's a long process, and pretty much the majority of that time was dedicated to the getting out process, turning in gear and getting signatures and that kind of thing, and going to required classes, separating classes, that kind of thing.
So when you're leaving Afghanistan, what is your reaction to leaving? What are the emotions you were feeling?
We were very happy to be leaving. It had been a really long deployment for my battalion. We had a lot of KIAs. I think we had 25 in the battalion and 28 including our attachments for killed in action, and more than 200 catastrophically wounded, meaning, you know, permanently injured, lost a leg, lost an arm. We had double and triple amputees. It was pretty brutal. So when that time started to come around where our replacement battalion, which was 1st Battalion, 5th Marines, they came finally, and we started doing transition with them, showing them how to do things on post, what to look for, kind of trying to teach them what we learned on the job. It kind of started, I think, to finally sink in that, hey, we're not going to be here that much longer. And it was another excellent feeling. It was kind of like, you know, don't talk about it too much, because, you know, as soon as you start talking about, hey, we're almost out of here, that's about the time you get an unlucky mortar round or something like that. So we didn't talk about it a lot, but for sure people were kind of like counting down the days. I'm sure they were. I was happy to have done our job. We were proud of what we did. We did a lot of, you know, we did work. We sent out thousands of patrols. We covered huge amounts of area, found hundreds of IEDs, killed a lot of Taliban. We did our job very well. So we were happy that the deployment was over. And yet on the other hand, there were still parts of, you know, everybody kind of had a little bit, a part of them that wanted to stay on longer, until our battalion sergeant major kind of took away that opportunity. You couldn't stay on and change units and stay and, you know, kind of stay on a little bit longer with that next deployment with that next battalion. Because I think a lot of people would have done that. I was thinking about it, and they kind of made the decision for me and didn't allow anybody.
When you were training the next crew, what was that like? Do you think that could you feel the feelings of the new guys and how they were adjusting, and like did you feel like you had good things to tell them, like as far as tactics and like things to look out for and stuff?
Absolutely, yeah, we definitely did. We had learned so much about what to look for, and the things that you learn on the job are worth so much more than you could ever teach, you know, theoretically back in the States or something like that. So when they came, we tried to take as much of what we had learned and pass that down, because it's not very smart to just say, hey, you're going to learn it yourself or something like that. So we tried to pass on as much as we could. We taught them what to look for, where to go, what to avoid, how to do things. We tried to pass on as much as we could, and we took them out on a few patrols. Like there would be joint patrols where part of one of their squads would come out with our squad, and they would see how we did things, where we went, how, you know, we started doing double posts where when we were on post, one of their Marines would come up on our post and point out things. Oh, do you see that guy over there? Well, see how he's digging like that. He looks suspicious. You want to investigate that and keep eyes on him for a while. And if he's, you know, tell him kind of what to look for based on the ROEs, which are the rules of engagement, when you can engage an enemy, that kind of thing. But sometimes they'd be digging and you'd say, oh, well, yeah, he's in the cornfield. He's trying to dig a new ditch because it got torn up the other day or something. He's just doing some farming, what to look for, kind of that kind of thing. So for sure it was, you know, trying to pass on everything that we learned because we were pretty good at our jobs by then. We'd been doing it for so long. We were used to it. We knew what it was. And I'm sure that they appreciated it because the news about what happened to us, definitely they knew exactly what was happening to us. And I'm sure there was a little bit of nervousness of like, oh man, what are we getting into here? But we tried to pass on as much as we could and prepare them as well as possible.
So you come home from Afghanistan. How is your life coming back from the war? Kind of talk about those first couple months.
It was definitely a strange transition to go from life and death every day where you're on post and or on patrol and to then go back to where you're completely safe, kind of relatively. It was definitely kind of a honeymoon phase for a long time. When we first came back, it was kind of like the best day of my life, coming back from Afghanistan, seeing my family waiting for me in California. We were really, really excited. And after that started wearing off, you know, then I'm trying to think of the best way to describe it. It was a probably helped that we were still, you know, that they didn't just immediately cut us back to civilian life or anything like that, that I had so many months to kind of go from combat environment to just military environment. And then when I finally got out in August, to kind of have that tiered exit was a little bit structured. It helped out for sure. I got to do medical and they checked me out and all that because I had some head problems and all that from getting my head rocked around a little bit. But I think, are you looking for like generally how everybody did or me specifically?
You.
Okay. Yeah, that for me, that was my experience. It was just the right amount of time to kind of change your mentality because when you go from that kind of every minute is kind of life or death to back in the States where, oh, well, I can drive around my car. And even I remember even specifically thinking getting in my car that, oh, wow, I can see so much better because I'm not driving an MRAP with like a 1 foot by 1 foot windshield. I can actually see all around me. And walking around was definitely a different transition because in Afghanistan, you learn that you don't walk on paths. You try to walk as unpredictably as possible. So whenever we were walking around to avoid IEDs, you know, we'd walk kind of like weird routes to try to avoid places where that they would try to plant IEDs. And so when you came back to the United States, that was still kind of, people were still doing that. And Marines were still doing that. And it kind of took a while to teach yourself, hey, there's no IEDs in California. You're going to be fine. You can walk on the trail. Everybody does it. That's the best place to walk. So it was those kinds of things that took a while to get used to, for sure, but it ended up working out well.
What is something that the Marines has taught you?
It can always be worse. Your situation can always be worse. I remember specifically thinking on post, we were standing post for a long time, cold, miserable, pretty creepy at nighttime when you can't see very much around you and there's an enemy force and you're in their home and they're trying to kill you. So I just remember specifically thinking, man, I wish I were a college student studying for a test or something like that, because then the worst case scenario was I fail the test but not get my head shot off. So it definitely, and I'll say this to this day, you know, there are a lot of great things about the Marines. They teach you, you know, the value of discipline, of being prepared, working as a team. You know, they provide you with veterans get the GI Bill for school. That's an excellent thing, and anybody who says that the GI Bill isn't great is an idiot, in my opinion. So they give you a lot of great things, but the best one is definitely the gift of perspective. You know, things can be always be way, way worse. So I'm really lucky that I understand now. I'm a very lucky guy. You know, I could be dead right now. I could be severely, you know, permanently injured. But I wasn't. So I'm lucky that way. And it's hard for me to complain about, you know, a little slight in my day-to-day life now, because I think, you know, how can I complain about there being a long line to get coffee when there's somebody else out there with it way worse than me? So it's hard for me to complain about things like that.
I think, you know, I've got to head out in around 10 minutes, but, I mean, I only have a couple more questions. Like, So, you know, your whole experience from joining the Marines to coming back to California and being done with all of it, seeing it now, if you knew that that was what you were going to do, would you do it again?
I've thought about this, that exact question in my head hundreds of times, and every time I come up with the same answer that yes, indeed, I would go back and do it again, probably with gritted teeth and probably with a different attitude. But I don't even know if that would be better to have the attitude that I have now when I was fresh, because you kind of need to have the better attitude that you start off with so that you can coast downhill. But if I had the same one that I ended with at the beginning, it would have been pretty much more miserable in some situations. So I guess if there were that time machine and I had that option, my answer is always that, yeah, I would do it again, but it would definitely have a different flavor the second time around.
Nice. What do you think is the best lesson that the Marines have taught you, or any of the guys you know that have gone through the Marines, like as far as leadership?
As far as leadership?
I've thought about that a lot because I know a lot of you guys. And
right. Lead from the front. There are so many different, it's, you know, I don't even feel right trying to rank them, which is the best lesson or anything like that. It would be hard to do that, but for sure, lead from the front. To be a good leader, you know, you need to be a good follower. You can't ask somebody to do something that you're not willing to do yourself. Can't be a hypocrite. You can't say one thing and do another. You have to be somebody that can be respected, not feared. And there are a lot of other lessons too, but though I feel like that's a pretty good representation of them, those ones I just said.
What's on your wrist right there? Is that something to do?
Yeah, this is a KIA bracelet that I can't remember if I ordered it or if they were handed out when we first came back from Afghanistan. This is a KIA bracelet, and it kind of commemorates the four Marines that were killed in my company on our deployment. So it's got their names on it, and it's just something that, you know, it's one of my most prized possessions. I think I only take it off when I'm going through security at the airport. I think that's the only time I can remember ever taking it off. It's just something, you know, I kind of feel like wearing it in their honor, and for everybody, for all Marines over there who were killed, you know, just kind of, even though this is only our company's KIA, but it's just kind of, you know, keep them in my mind and that kind of thing. Same thing with my sweatshirt. This is a sweatshirt that I ordered when we first got back, and it's kind of like a deployment sweatshirt that has got fallen Marines on the back of it, and it's just, you know, I hold these, you know, these are really valuable to me, so that's why I wore them today for this interview.
That's great.
Before we stop, do you have anything else that you'd like to add or that you don't think we've covered?
No, that's, I feel like that's pretty much covered everything. So I thought those, you know, there's nothing that I wanted to say specifically that I didn't. I feel like you guys got pretty good coverage there. And I sure appreciate the opportunity to share my experiences and hopefully help out with this project. And
yeah. Yeah, thank you very much. Well, yeah, just